have a panel now titled Fleet Renewal, Ships and Fuel of Today and Tomorrow. This is what we were meant to be discussing, but given how the previous panel ended, I don't know what we will discuss, given they covered the majority of this topic, but I'm sure we will find many things to discuss and hear people's views. Now, we have a very high-profile panel with people representing some of the biggest ship-owning companies and organizations in the maritime sphere, so I'd like to introduce each of them. We have first Spiros Leousis, who's the Chief Commercial Officer of Capital Product Partners, Andreas Hadzipetrou, who's the CCO of Columbia Group and the Managing Director of Columbia Ship Management, Semiramis Paliou, who's the CEO of Diana Shipping and also the chairperson of Helmepa and Intermepa, Yanis Hiotopoulos, the Senior Vice President and Regional Manager Southeast Europe, Middle East and Africa of DNV, and George Karagiorgiou, the President and CEO of Olympic Shipping and Management. And just to set the scene, although, as I said, this has been done based on the previous panel, but, you know, the discussion today is to see, look at where the industry is today. We know what the targets are. Everyone knows what the expected targets are for 2030 and 2050. Where is the shipping industry on this journey? What is the proportion of ships which are ready for this transition? And is the industry on track to meet these targets? And also, we, as well as the industry, because that's part of the equation, the other part of the equation is seeing how, you know, is the infrastructure there? Is the supply there for the fuels of the future? And these are all important considerations in a time when there's a greatly changing environmental environment. Regulatory environment. And that has a huge impact on the decision-making process for all these companies and organizations. So what I wanted to touch on first is this sort of decision-making and how you go about in this environment doing this, especially when while the regulatory environment is clear in certain regions, as we heard before, it's not clear globally. So, Andreas, I think you have a view on sort of how to deal with this, you know, these considerations.
Thank you, George. Well, as you know, Columbian Group is a service organization. So the benefit we have is that we collaborate with clients worldwide with different, let's say, levels of expertise, standards, and different approaches with regards to shareholders' value and so on. What we see from our clients is that, which is a global phenomenon anyway, everybody's trying to build more economic ships, fuel efficient, energy savings, and they aim to provide digitalizations and ways of improving, in general, the efficiency of the ships. What we see as well is that the investment decisions on new type of fuels, they are there, but nobody really invests in only ammonia or only methanol and so on. Of course, there are a few very big organizations that they do this, but the vast majority of the owners, they still go with conventional fuels, and everybody talks about dual fuel, about methanol ready, ammonia ready, and so on. But we also know that if it's just ready, this means you need an additional huge investment so that you can run on those fuels when the ships are delivered. So basically, it's anybody's guess. I was talking with a client last week who placed an order with methanol-ready ships and was convinced that methanol is the way. And I had another meeting with a very big liner company where they said they now believe in ammonia. So it really depends on the way forward, and different organizations have different way of looking at it.
Thank you. And if I can then turn to Yanni on this point, given that you're the other service provider here, in terms of, you know, both within your organization and then in dealings with clients, how this impacts you and what support you're providing?
Since I'm representing DNV, we like very much facts. So let me go and dwell on some of these facts. And according to our Alternative Fuels Insight platform, it's a platform actually that everyone can register with free of charge, and you have all the information about alternative fuels, ordering, bunkering stations, availabilities, etc. around the world. So according to that, we have at this moment 7% of the world fleet capable running on non-conventional fuels. And from the ship order, if we are counting on gross tonnage, we are at about 50% of the ships on order, including LNG carriers, are, let's say, ready for conventional new fuels. Now, of course, you will ask me the question of what means ready and what means capable. And there is a difference there. So ready is prepared for future adoption without a significant modification. Now, how you translate significant depends on the company. Every company has a different way of interpreting significant. We have various ways to answer George your question, various ways of helping our clients. We have our DNV decarbonization pathway platform, where we can give ship-specific information and guidance to our clients how and what kind of strategy to create in order to be compliant and also efficient towards the new regulations. And also we have Emission Connect platform, which is also providing verified data for all the transactions and the emissions of the vessels, which can be available and transparent to all stakeholders. Because as we all know, the new ETS system is creating a new kind of commercial connections, and new contracts have to be in place between all the stakeholders, starting from cargo owners, charterers, ship managers, and classification societies at the end.
Thank you, Yanni. If I can now turn to the companies, and I'll start with Spiro first, but in terms of before saying what you're actually doing at this, what steps you've taken, I still want to focus on this, the decision making, and how in this greatly changing environment you go about that process, and what's different. Where do you go to source the information you need to make a decision?
Yeah, I think for us it's quite important to see what's actually available, because we need to make investment decisions with high capex. So it's very important to understand what fuels are actually available and what we see being available in the next 10-15 years. So far, our decision has been that we are focusing on LNG, dual-fuel vessels. So most of our on-order fleet are dual-fuel LNG. As we see that LNG is actually a fuel that will be available and transitions towards, let's say, solving the issue. We don't see anything else right now being available to build. I mean, ammonia carriers, it makes sense. But for the wider fleet, we don't really see how that could fit the case. There isn't enough ammonia supply. There will be a lot of competition for ammonia from co-firing with power plants. So we really don't see ammonia being, let's say, a big part of the fleet for the next 15-20 years. And our horizon so far is obviously 15-20 years, because it's the lifetime of our vessels. So the decision has been LNG. In terms of other fuels, methanol, again, we saw Maersk having a big methanol order, and then for the first voyage they used the grey methanol, which actually defeats the purpose, because it's more pollutant, you have more CO2 emissions rather than traditional fuels. So I think that's more or less from our part.
Thank you, Spiro. Semiramis, can I turn to you?
Yes. I constantly feel that I live in a moving environment, shipping environment. Every week that goes by, maybe even every day, I learn something new and I have to reevaluate and reassess my thoughts and decisions on how the industry is going. As you probably already know, we've placed an order for 2 dual fuel methanol dry bulk Kamsarmax vessels at Tsunesi. People ask whether this is whether I'm a strong believer of methanol. My answer is no, I'm not sure, and I think it is a transitional step. But I feel it's my duty to help the industry move forward into a more sustainable path. And I think with this order, this is what we're doing as a company. The culture of our people are getting used to the idea that we need to move forward. I just wanted to bring to the table as well another realization that I got a couple of weeks ago about all the new building orders that people are placing and the scrapping we will need to be doing sooner or later. Have we actually considered the greenhouse gas emissions these two processes contribute to the environment? So I'm feeling that we will have to start thinking differently at some point, where we'll actually have to think that the ships we already have on the water need to be, their life needs to be prolonged some way or another. So that's another parameter that has currently gone into my way of thinking, and it emphasizes the importance that we need to find ways to reduce the emissions on the existing ships, whether it is using biofuel, which is it is foreseen as a solution. And hopefully we won't have to compete with the aviation industry, because that is a major problem for the biofuels. But we need to invest in carbon capturing. We need to make sure that we use any methods that exist and will be invented to reduce the emissions of the current fleet.
Thank you. Thank you. And George, as well, if you want to follow Semiramis.
Well, Olympic Shipping is a traditional ship owner. We believe that we will have to build the vessels that our charters will need, provided that we will be willing to pay the price and the cost, because we need to differentiate between the liner market and the Trump business. It's very clear, and if you deep dive into the order book, you will see that, you know, the people or the companies that are engaged in the liner business are more willing to pay the extra cost in order to carry their cargo in a more environmentally friendly way. This happens because the cargo that is being carried by the liner business is generally more expensive than the cargo that is being carried on a bulk basis. So this is also reflected extensively on the order book. You see that the order book on the container ships, the gas ships, and the car carriers is far larger than the containers, than the order book that you have in dry bulk and tankers. Bulk transport is a very competitive business with thin margins, which is always governed by the delivered cost of the cargo at the destination. The charterer will have to pay for the additional cost of the fuel. And in the bulk transport business, the fuel cost is relatively much larger than what it is for the liner business. And this is why, you know, you have companies like Maersk and Messi and the big retailers like IKEA, which are willing to invest and pay the extra price to build with an uncertain technology at the moment, whilst, you know, private ship owners who are very careful with their money, looking at the bottom line, trying to ascertain whether the charterers will be able to pay the additional cost of the fuel and the technology needed to power the new ships, are still hesitant, and they are not progressing as fast as the other business. In Olympic, we are not investing at the moment. We finished our last investment period in 2020. If we were to build, we would have gone with conventional ships. We believe that the technology solutions that are being provided today are still evolving. The technology is not certain, and for that reason we would go conventional if we were to order. We are not ordering for other reasons. It has to do with financial returns at the moment. But in terms of fuel, if we were to order, we would go with conventional diesel power.
Thank you, George. And if I can just take that point, other than the segment, so you made that distinction between the liner companies and the container industry and dry bulk. But do you think, and this is going to be directed to Semir and Mr. Spiros, as public companies, is it easier or do you feel a greater pressure to make these investments? And is it easier because, you do a limited investment in very new fuels and see how that plays out, as opposed to if you were running private companies?
I think, for us to be honest, I don't see a difference. I think the decision, the returns need to be there in both cases. So we don't really see a difference between the public and the private side. I think the investment thesis is the same for both companies, and I think that's probably the way to walk around, solid financials. To the last point, I agree. I think liners are easier to, let's say, to invest into dual fuel when there isn't a market force measure. And that's, for us, we like the market-based measures like the ETS, because this actually helps us to build dual fuel vessels. I mean, we are building dual fuel Suezmaxes and Aframaxes on the basis that they will be trading euro for spot account in order to take advantage of the ETS and the lower fuel cost. So I think as market-based measures, let's say, grow and hopefully become the base going forward, I think it will be easier for ship owners to make the investment decision.
Yes, I'll agree with Andreas. I don't think we feel the pressure from our investors specifically to go into more alternative fuels. We are, however, also investing in methanol dual fuels, mainly because we want to work with big charterers that we feel will feel the pressure of the market-based measures that are coming in. They, in return, need to show to their customers, because they are closer to the customers than we are, that they're doing something about the green and reduced emissions transportation. Don't forget, they need to, European companies need to announce their scope 3 emissions. That includes transportation. So companies based in Europe will place a lot of importance on the emissions produced during transportation for the products.
George, can I just add something?
Yes, please.
I think it's clear that if you're a container liner, you can control your trade, so it's easier for you to predict where the ships are going to be at which time, and then obviously you can plan accordingly, whereas if you're a tank operator, bulkers, tankers, it's much more difficult. So I think this is a very important element in the decision making.
Okay, thank you. If I can just move to another area, because what we've seen within the industry is that some companies, and Maersk was discussed before, was referenced before, but others as well are forming joint ventures or some types of loose arrangements with companies, which green or tech companies, in order to be able to get a better understanding of what is available, what the future will look like. I'd just be interested to hear from any of you, whether your organizations are doing this and also the benefits of this. Andreas?
Thank you. Well, to be honest, George, I can talk now for 20 minutes.
Okay.
But I will not do this. I think what we have done, we have opened up our horizons for a few years now, trying to build up relationships with other industries, obviously clients, different educational institutions, and so on, so that we can learn as well from other society, from other groups of knowledge. What we have done just recently, we teamed up with CETA. CETA, for those of you who are not aware, they dominate the aviation industry in terms of providing support. They have, I believe, they are represented in 90% of the world ports, of the world airports, and they have the platform that connects the passenger, the luggage, the check-in and the transition of the passenger, the biometrics, and so on. And they have, of course, planned maintenance for ships, for the planes. They have the entire technology with regards to aviation. Are we going to be able to bring this into shipping successfully? It's a question mark. But we have to try. And we have, having had the chance to discuss with CETA, they are convinced that there are savings to be made also for the shipping industry. At the same time, we built it up a venture capital sort of arrangement where we invite young people to come up with ideas, any startups, so that we can innovate and find ways of improving the carbon footprint of the organizations and the ships, and to improve in general the shipping industry. So you have to find a way to improve. This is not only for us, I believe many companies are doing it, but it's important to learn from each other and work closer together so we can improve the totality of our carbon footprint.
Thank you, Andreas.
We have a couple of joint ventures into new technology. Apart from working with charters in investing in nanotechnology paints, so we're sharing the cost, we're sharing the learning experience, and we're sharing the risks. We're working very closely with a Chinese team on carbon capture. The government of China, and this is progressing relatively smoothly. We're just looking for a charterer willing to participate in this team effort. And maybe I could quickly refer to Blue Visby, which is also a pilot project that we're participating in. It's virtually virtual twin of our ship. It has to do with trying to make sure that optimizing the time that the ship arrives in port. So rather than speeding up and waiting for 3 days outside the port to discharge or to load, adjust your speed so that you arrive just in time to go into berth. And that way you reduce your emissions because you obviously need to go slower. That's a collaboration apart from the owners, charterers. You need to collaborate with the ports, the receivers, and the shippers. So it's a very interesting project we're involved in.
Thank you, Semira. And I know George wants to speak.
Yes. No? In Olympic, even though we don't build any new ships, we have invested and formed, teamed up with another two major Greek owners, and we formed a research company 2 years ago. The purpose of that company is to really understand and develop as much as possible the carbon capture technology. We have already started and done a few trials, and our partner is the National Technical University of Athens and Eketa, a research center up in the northern part of Greece. We're also developing some new research on biofuels. We believe that biofuels is the easy way to deal with the energy transition going forward for the next 5 years. And we've also done a very big project with the Global Center for Maritime Decarbonization, which is based in Singapore, on the value chain of the whole carbon economy. And last but not least, we have also an agreement with Core Power, a UK company, which is dealing and they're trying to marinize the nuclear technology that TerraPower is forming in the US in order to basically use small modular nuclear reactors aboard ships. But this is something that is definitely for the next decade.
Thank you, George.
I can add from our side, we have been participating in the Maritime Technologies Forum, which is bringing together flags, major classes, and governments to support and try to investigate and find new ways and clear ways, transparent ways, where all the stakeholders can benefit from that. We are part of what George just mentioned, the Global Maritime Decarbonization Forum. And I'm really glad to hear that also other companies are coming into partnership and exploring new opportunities in order to make the world more efficient, because partnerships and collaboration is probably the fuel of the future. And I would like to mention here that in order to achieve the IMO's ambitions for 2030 and 2050, there is a need of many things. And there is a need of a major technological advancement. There is a need of a lot of money to come into play. And I think that we are maybe missing, the low-hanging fruits here. And I can mention a couple, like vessels arriving on time. And that can be a major reduction in emissions. And that is just a logistic issue. And there is also a lot of things that can be done in our daily operational lives, which can save a lot of emissions and can be done also now, rather than alternative fuels, which of course is a way of the future, but it's maybe a bit in the long run.
Thank you, Yanni. And it's clear from what everyone has said that, you know, Semiram, as you said before about the fact that it's a challenging time, unclear, and, you know, it is a very challenging time, but this seems a little bit different in that there seems to be much more collaboration from actors outside the industry as well. And this is something that's being embraced by the industry. I mean, a very important part of the industry that we need to talk about is also the seafarers as well. And how all this, the new technology, the changes that are happening, but will happen in the future, how that impacts on them as well. So I don't know who wants to go first. I know that Andreas has told me that this is something he wants to speak about.
Well, I think that crewing is probably the most underestimated issue we have in the industry, because we are all suffering out of lack of high expertise, lack of knowledge, experience with the new types of propulsion. Obviously, that's another issue. So what is required is a common way into training as well, and common way in developing the seafarers. And I think we should not forget that what we are going through is not the problem of one company or one segment or a region. This is a common problem where we basically need to work together to find ways. The seafarer of the future will definitely be paid more than today. They will be more qualified, trained much better, and simulator training at the initial stages of the new fuels will also be very, very important, because simply there is no there are no ships at sea that they sail in this way. And we have to look as well into the soft skills of the seafarer. So the whole approach into crewing needs to be revisited, and we have to be very sensitive on the way forward. As per statistics that I have seen by accident, actually, a couple of days ago, 16-17% of the seafarers are either recruited by ship managers or trained by ship managers. So the remaining more than 80% is basically individual companies recruiting their own seafarers or through manning agencies. This in the future will have to be probably more controlled, even though I hate controls, but there is a way forward into the recruitment and qualification of the seafarers of the future.
Thank you, Andrea.
Yes, George and Andrea, I think you've touched upon a very, very important topic, something that Helmepa, and George can support this here, has been working on very consciously. We will need at least 800,000 seafarers to be trained and skilled in the next couple of years in order to be able to handle safely the new fuels that are coming in and the new regulations. And that is over and above the talent we need to attract into our industry. There is scarcity of seafarers, there is scarcity of people coming into the sector, which is a really beautiful sector and has incredible potentials of development. However, that I think emphasizes the importance we have to show on our seafarers for the future. They are our future.
Thank you, Semiramis. If we can, because we're getting near to the end of the time, if we can just look to the future a little bit. A number of you have mentioned carbon capture, making investments in that technology. What are you seeing, and what is your expectation about that sort of the regulatory environment changing there?
We are probably, we have the first four liquid CO2 carriers on order on 22,000 cubes. So we have looked in this space quite a lot. We believe that that will be a big element of decarbonization going forward. We don't see any way to reach the targets of 2040 and 2050 without significant investment into carbon capturing. So for us, it's quite important. We are also working together with our partners here in Greece for carbon capturing on board, especially for the liquid CO2 carriers. That makes a lot of sense because we will have where to actually dispose the cargo, the captured CO2. So while I think it will take some time for the wider use of carbon capture on board, because you need the whole supply chain to be developed around this, but I think it will be a significant part of the decarbonization of the industry, especially considering the lack of alternatives, as I said previously.
Thank you, Spiro.
We believe that the world will not be able to decarbonize without using carbon capture technologies, at least in the beginning. In the land business, in the land industries, the technology is well developed. However, in the marine sector, it has not yet been fully developed, and there are a lot of challenges that need to be overcome. This is why we have formed that research company that I told you earlier about.
Yes, obviously carbon capture is very important. What I wanted to share with you is something that I met the CEO of Climeworks a month ago. He was very excited to share with me that they are into the direct air capture of carbon. And he was very excited to share with me that they were setting up that the first factory or plant was up and running in Iceland. And they're aiming to capture about 36,000 tons per year of carbon. And I thought that was an exciting news, as I remember reading the article in Times magazine maybe about 6 or 7 years ago about the futuristic approach of how we would save the planet by sucking up the air and removing the CO2 from it to reduce the effect on climate. And I just realized that that was actually a reality, and it made me realize how fast technology progresses and how sci-fi ideas actually can materialize and slowly save the planet. So I wanted to share it with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
What I wanted to say was that, carbon capture is going to be difficult and it's going to be expensive. But it's going to allow us for the next 10, 15 years to run our ships, our conventional ships, with conventional fuels. And as a transition, I think it's a very good technology.
I agree fully. And I think this is also the... very similar to the car industry, where carbon capturing is considered a way forward.
Okay. Now, in the previous panel, we had Polis, who made a made a prediction for the future, which he said that with nuclear, we won't see it in this generation. Yeah, no. Well, I'm not too far away in age from you. So is that an accurate prediction? In the next 30, 40 years, it won't happen?
Well, I can tell you, by talking to Core Power, they expect to have the first available reactor for marinized for testing available in the early to mid 2030s. And that's an expectation. So, you know, don't counter it.
I also wanted to say that, as I said, technology is progressing very quickly. I was talking to another gentleman from Tokamak reactors, and he was saying that maybe up until recently people thought that nuclear was far away, 30 years, but now with artificial intelligence they've managed to bypass modeling issues and has brought the technology much closer. So they were forecasting 10 years away.
I think I will differ on that. I will side with not in our generation, probably pickup line, because I think the main issue there would be security and safety rather than technology. The technology is mature enough. There is the technology there. We have already ships that are powered by nuclear, but I think to have that in a safe and secure, mostly secure, imagine like, you know, a nuclear power driven bulk carrier going into New York or Rotterdam. I think that would be a kind of difficult to handle for the local population.
Actually, if I may, we were talking about that recently and someone reminded me of the air carriers, the American air carriers that come into port in Piraeus and people go up to see them and have a tour. Well, do they actually realize that they're nuclear powered?
No, I agree. These are actually, you know, these are warships. So they have the security in place to make sure that nothing happens. That's a concept. I mean, unless you have like a bulk carrier, they would carry security guards, or I don't know how that would work. In terms of it's more of a security rather than a safety concern, I would say.
May I add one more risk to the conversation? Cybersecurity. Because all of this will be run in a cloud, billions of data will have to be transferred from one place to the other, and we have to be really making sure that this is done in a safe and secure way, as you said.
The technology is inherently safe, so at least that is clear.
Yeah, I just wanted to say what Samir and Mr. said, that the new technology for the small, medium reactors is inherently safe. Even if something happens to the fuel, the core solidifies and it stays like that, frozen, without emitting any isotopes or radiation. But again, it's still under development, at least 10 years away.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think this is a good place to stop, given that we're looking to the future. Thank you.